The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Welcome back to Global Reach, the show that helps your business deal with the risks and opportunities in the global marketplace. I'm your host, Tay Revez. And if we're talking about risks and opportunities, few markets are more tantalizing or more challenging than China. But for many American and European companies, the competitive environment and the cultural differences are so complex that they fail to realize their goals. Well, my guest, Marco Chan, is going to shed some light on this and help us deal with cultural differences and those market complexities. Marco is the founder and CEO of AmAsia 3. It's a company that engages in trans-Pacific commerce and helps companies develop cross-cultural and cross-disciplinary go-to-market programs. He is an expert on what it takes to expand into China. A Hong Kong native and a veteran of multiple international assignments, he started up FedEx's operations in China, and now he's helping other companies do the same. Welcome, Marco, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Tay. It's my pleasure.
Let's start out with a question that really is on everyone's mind when they're looking at China. We're going to have a transition to a new generation of Chinese political leaders expected for the middle of 2012. The people doing business in China want to know how it's going to affect them. This generation was brought up during the Cultural Revolution, so their perspective is going to be different from the old guard. How's it going to affect their outlook? What do you think?
Well, based on the discussion that I have with people who work with the leadership group, and I think you can also reflect on the recent visit by Vice President or Vice Chair or the future President for China, the next party secretary, Mr. Xi. You know, his viewpoint is quite liberal, and I believe that his viewpoint is very pro-business. And that's the general speculation, that the pro-business environment will continue, or actually may even accelerate.
Really? Well, you've seen stronger development of private businesses over the last few years. So you're saying you think that the new business is going to continue down that road?
Well, that's based on my understanding from the people who are working with the top leadership within the government, and looking at all the trends and looking at what they have been talking about in the five-year plan, those are the indication, and that's the way I would interpret that too.
How do you think they'll balance relationships with the state-owned enterprises and foreign-owned enterprises?
Well, I think being a WTO member, China is going to continue, at least on the surface, embrace, you know, foreign ownership. As far as how they're going to balance between state-owned enterprise versus foreign-owned enterprise or even privately-owned enterprise within China, that is something that it's not a crystal ball, but then it is going to be a balancing act form. Some of the state-owned enterprises are actually acting more and more private, and especially they have listing in the United States or in other stock exchange centers.
You mentioned the WTO. Now, there's a suit in the WTO from European and U.S. governments. Is that going to poison relations with the private sector, foreign-owned private sector?
I really do not know. That I cannot answer. I really do not know how that would impact the private sectors.
When we were talking before the show, you mentioned that the new leaders are likely to focus on the 90% of Chinese who haven't made it economically, and the government's going to channel investment to avoid another cultural revolution. That really struck me. Can you explain to me what you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of wealthy Chinese. You can see Chinese are spending a lot more money on different things, on luxury items, wine, etc. The situation is 10% of the Chinese population in very good shape economically. And I think the government are looking at this, that now is the time to really take care of the 90% that are still not there. And I mentioned cultural revolutions as a reference point because I think, you know, within China, the dynasty change, the revolution, any kind of negative kind of activities always happen because the poor people or the mass of the population that are in the lower economic status have difficulty either making ends meet, and that's when problem occur. And I think that is more what I'm referring to, that the Chinese government want to have a stable population, a stable country, and I think the way they are going to do it is to do more for those who do not have anything, and they're the one that most probably are the least satisfied with life in general, and subsequently the government.
Now, where do you think they're going to channel investment? How is this going to translate into potential opportunities for the private sector companies that are in the second tier,
the third tier cities, as well as in some of the rural area, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of water, in terms of healthcare, energy, environmental, food. These are the basic things. I mean, if we get the road system going to this, they are now going to be connected to the major financial centers, and they will get a chance to, quote unquote, having better economic opportunities. Having the accessibility is what is going to help this second tier and third tier cities and the rural area.
Now, you mentioned one of the areas was water, which, I mean, is we just passed World Water Day, and there's been a Goldman Sachs report go back to 2008 saying that water is the next petroleum of the 21st century. And I know that China is very short on water and is bringing down its aquifers. Is the Chinese government going to let foreign-owned companies into developing water infrastructure?
I'm not sure if the Chinese government will let foreign companies develop water infrastructure for them. I think the Chinese believe they can do it themselves. They have proven it in, you know, creating the Three Gorges, and they're doing the diversion of the Yangtze River going up north. And I mean, very much they have the capability as well as the capacity. Now, but in like all these major projects, there are many components. And, you know, even in the Three Gorges, there are many components that have been handled by foreign companies. So I see a lot of these opportunities available for anyone who have the technology and or the process or, you know, or some way of helping the Chinese to make these things happen.
Okay. And can you comment maybe on the opportunities in the healthcare sector here?
Healthcare sector, as you know, a lot of the Chinese actually, from a demographic standpoint, are getting older. I mean, there are a lot of Chinese who are in the 70s and the 80s. It caused by several social factors. I mean, the migrant worker situation, so people are not, you know, staying where they're from, and the aged parents are left alone, and they have a need to take care of this senior. So I think the second thing is Chinese healthcare has always been a big challenge for the government. I mean, if you go to China, most of the hospitals, they have beds, not unusual, they have 4,000, 5,000, 8,000 beds in a hospital.
Huge.
And the care of the people, because of the massive numbers, and then at the same time, the medical personnel that are available to take care of them, and at the same time, the pharmaceutical, the medical resources that are readily available at reasonable prices for the general public are quite lacking. And I think they will be spending a lot of time trying to figure a way to help in this particular sector.
So would you see that the opportunities here for foreign-owned companies might be in the pharmaceutical sector, the medical device sector?
I truly believe that, and there are plenty of examples. There are a lot of companies. I mean, all the Big Ten or whatever you may call it, all the brand name pharmaceutical companies are in China. I mean, they do various things. Some of them are doing research and development. Some of them are trying to figure out how to tap into the myths of the Chinese medicine. But at the same time, most of them are trying to sell their products to the Chinese. And so Chinese have problem
to,
in
let's now turn to the other
diabetes
segment, Marco.
Yes.
The 10%, China's middle class, 200 to 300 million people who are making $25,000 a year on average. That's about what, equivalent to 40 to 50,000 in the US?
Yeah, I would say that.
Now, companies want to sell into that growing middle class, and that's a huge market.
Yeah.
What segments represent the best opportunities for them?
Well, there are quite a few segments. I mean, the most talked about reasonable, you know, recently are wines and all these luxury good items. That's one of them. But the wines are really not consumed by the people who purchase them. A lot of them are buying the wines as gifts, especially for Chinese New Year and some of the festivals. Fashions, cosmetics, healthcare products, you know, a brand name product. I mean, Chinese people who are, you know, who have arrived, I mean, they are wearing $1,000, $2,000 suits, you know, Italy or European, and you know, women, same thing. They are looking for fashions, but at the same time, the travel industry is also growing. They're starting to travel overseas, you know, first to Southeast Asia, now to Europe and to the United States. So all those sectors are opportunities for anyone who wants to get in there. Neiman Marcus recently just made the announcement they're trying to figure a way to sell their product online to the Chinese market.
Interesting. We've got to go to break now. When we come back, I know that you've got a wine club going in Hong Kong. Maybe you'll tell us a little bit about how you're positioning wines to sell to the Chinese market. And then we're going to go to break, so stay tuned.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for staying on with us. I'm here with my guest, Marco Chan, the founder and CEO of Amasia 3. And he was just about to tell us a little bit about the wine club that they're trying to set up in Hong Kong. I understand that hasn't been going smoothly.
Well, we run into some challenges. We have identified there's a market there. The challenge is the logistics side. Actually, it's the last mile. Once we get the logistics issues resolved, and we hope to, I believe our business model for that wine club will work very, very well. There's a lot of people who are in Hong Kong who would love to get some American wines.
Be good for the industry here, too.
Absolutely.
A little bit like it is in Japan, where this is really a prestige item?
Well, for the Chinese in Hong Kong, it's more a hip item. I mean, now they have passed the French wine stage, and, you know, they are looking for new wines. You know, as far as they're concerned, America is one of them.
One of the things we talked about when we were discussing this show ahead of time is that the really deep cultural differences between the Western companies and the Chinese. Now, what are some of the key cultural values that we need to consider when we're communicating with the Chinese?
Well, there are two or three major things. Number one, the Chinese are very relationship-oriented, or they prefer to know the people that they do business with first before talking about business. And it's such that they want to know you. And so if you do a cold call, that doesn't work. If you are being referred by somebody, then it's no longer a cold call. That will work. And you have to know the people that you work with so they can size you up, so they can trust you before you even start talking about business. So that's number one. Number two, you know, the Chinese term is called minji, that is face. It's very, very important to understand the concept. And, you know, it will take a little while to really go through all of it. Minji is really a face. It's not just a Chinese thing. It's in many, many countries, even in the United States. But at the same time, Chinese tend to be a lot more sensitive to that.
Can you define what you mean by face? One reads
face
about it.
That's a Chinese saying. Men live for face, as tree grows for bark. Okay? So they want to have face. You know, that means they want to be honored, respected, and treated as being superior. And that's face to them.
Okay, so how do you give someone face, or how do you not, or how do you damage face? What do you need to do to work with this concept?
Well, the easiest thing for some people to feel they lose face is if you ask them a question that they don't have an answer, you know that they don't know it, then they will lose face. And so if you ask questions that you know that they know the answer, you allow them to show that they are knowledgeable in that area, and so they will lose face. At the same time, you know, never criticize anybody in public. I mean, not even the slightest hint. The dry humor, the cynical type of, you know, those kind of conversations do not work in China. So refrain from those. To give face, show respect. I mean, and there are many ways of doing that.
Give us some examples.
Well, I mean, the deferring of, even sitting down, you know, and not just shaking hands, but, you know, if I am going to meet with you, and I would, you know, even if I know the answer, I will ask you, oh, Ms. Tay, what do you think about it? You know, and you would say, oh, Marco, I think you know more than that. This kind of seems, you know, minor, seems minute, but the deferring the respect to the other person would allow the other person to gain faith.
How do you do that without appearing weak yourself?
There is no such thing as being weak in the in China. I mean, they look at that as humility. And being assertive is very important in America. But in China, being assertive is not being perceived as that you are knowledgeable and that you are not being weak, that you are being strong. To them, the strongest thing is like water. I mean, it is, you know, it's quiet. It moves very, it can be slow, it can be fast. You don't have to really stand out to be known.
But water is truly powerful.
They truly believe that, you know, water runs deep, and they believe that people who are knowledgeable, they are the one who is the quiet ones. They're the one who stays silent, and they don't show off. Those who show off, there's a saying in Chinese that you know, you never trust those people who show off that they have all this, and they know all this, and they know all that. So that's a difference of perception in culture.
That's a fairly deep difference, particularly from some of the American business culture, I'd say particularly
very
New York business culture.
Very different, and it's recognized even by, say, for example, by me when I first worked for an American company. If I don't speak up, I'll be looked at as, I have no idea, I don't know anything, I'm ignorant, and, you know, or I got push over. But in China, that's very much the opposite.
And if I'm meeting with a potential Chinese business associate, what do they expect from me? Do they have preconceived ideas or stereotypes about me as an American?
You know, surprisingly, my own experience with the modern-day China business environment, they don't. They don't have any preconceived notion. They go in on one-on-one. And my recommendation to, say, you, if you go into a business in China, have somebody introduce you and give all your credential, if you really want to be assertive, but not by yourself. You know, so it's okay for somebody to talk about all the great things that you do, as long as it doesn't come from you. And that's a very indirect way of communication that Chinese practice.
That's fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. So I want to, let's take the next step on the, well, let me ask you first, how long or how many times should I be meeting with someone before we start to talk about, you know, solid business ideas? We might say get down to brass tacks.
Well, my own experience, if you have never met somebody over there the first time, it would take 2 or 3 times before you really can get down to business. The signal that I would be counting on is when they start asking about the business issue, then I'll start sharing. And that's my signal, because they know that I'm there for business. And when they ask me the question, I'll say, oh, you know, what kind of product do you have, or what kind of service are you providing? That gives me an indication that they are ready. Now, how long it takes really depends on the individual, but most of the time, all the experience that I have, it would be probably the second or the third. You are real lucky if you get to on the second time, but most of the time, the third time around, on the face-to-face, you know, you can really, you normally will have the opportunity to get into deep dive.
So if you're going back for a third time, is that also taken as a sign of your commitment
Very much so. And if you're being invited back for the third time, it means that they like you, or they believe they already have enough time to do enough due diligence on you. Believe that they will check you out.
You said one should be introduced by somebody they would already know. Should you bring that person with you on the meetings?
Yes. Normally in the first meeting, yes. But most of the time, depending on what you will call this intermediary, you know, whether it's just an introduction, or the person probably will be able to gauge whether they still have to be involved to kind of handhold the process. That most of the time when it gets down to the business of, you know, between the two parties, that quote unquote, the intermediary that did the introduction is not required to be present. No.
So starting in this building the one-on-one relationship, and we've got about 3 minutes to break, so I want to get started on this. How do you start from that basis to build a business network in China?
Well, you start. My advice to people is, you know, start talking to the Chinese people in the United States or in your neighborhood, in your business circle, and talk to them and get to know them and see who they can refer you to talk to, and just like LinkedIn, right? And so you from one to another. I think those who are here probably get Americanized enough that you don't have to go through all that. So. That would be my first step, trying to find the right people.
Would it make sense to start making contacts with students at the business schools?
Yeah, I would. I would go to give a lecture in a business school to talk about your company, and it makes sense to them. And if they know that, and if this is something that they know somebody, and I would even go to colleges that have a lot of Chinese students from China. And most of them, I would say over half of them, have are from very good families, and they have very good connections back in China that can help.
I was also noticing, I went to Columbia School of International and Public Affairs, and I was looking at some of the student backgrounds there, and quite a lot of them have, you know, business or government experience before they come to the foreign graduate school. So would it make sense to see if you can develop relationships with them to tap those relationships?
I absolutely would. And actually, you know, if you look at the news, there's quite a few high-level Chinese officials that have children going to very reputable school here in the United States. In Harvard, Walton, MIT, UCLA. So those are a lot of good opportunities.
Now, when I looked at your website, one of the things that you mentioned was that companies, when they're manufacturing in China, often find that the supplier network behaves differently from what they expect here. The different view of deadlines, of supplies. So how do you start to pick out the reliable suppliers? So Okay. Everybody stay tuned, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
How can we Americans realize our dreams to earn a living? How can you pursue your dream and make money as an owner or an employee? Learn how at The American Business Person, the online weekly radio talk show hosted by Rich Killian. Today's business leaders share how to succeed and what fails. If you own a new or established business or ever hope to, you must tune in. Join us every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Central, and noon Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel, or listen on demand to our archived shows.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
Is your business model robust enough? In today's ever-changing business environment, people are working to transform themselves, their futures, and their business. Tune in to Business Reinvention with your host, Nancy Lynn. To stay ahead of the game in business, you have to constantly reinvent yourself and your organization. With Nancy's experience and that of her guest experts, you'll learn from stories of inspiration, innovation, and forward thinking. Listen for Business Reinvention live every Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm here with Marco Chan. He is the founder of Amasia 3, and we were talking during the break about something very interesting. Marco mentioned that this radio, if you tried to run a business meeting the way we're running this radio show, very much on the clock, this would cause you problems. This is a very American way to run a meeting, but it wouldn't work in China. Why, Marco?
That is very true, because Americans are very fixed time oriented. That's what I would call it. That, you, like you said, you live by the clock, by your watch, you know, every single second and every single minute counts. In China, we look at time as a very fluid thing. You know, schedules should not be determining what needs to be discussed. You know, time is just a consequence. We can have 5,000 years. We can deal with things in the next generation. So if you try to limit and say you have 30 seconds or 60 seconds to respond, you're not going to get some very good answer from the Chinese because of their time value.
That's really a very profound difference. I remember doing research years ago, and everybody I met from Asia kept saying, Americans are clocks. You live by the clock. You are a clock.
And we don't function that way. And the Chinese recognize that. And in negotiation, they turn it around and take advantage of the American. They would not negotiate with you or come to the real terms until they know that you have only 30 minutes to get your flight home.
Oh,
then
very, very interesting.
In a hurry,
so have a backup
decision.
Flight.
They said, well, if I don't do it, they can come back or whatever. But for you, if you want to make, you know, to come with something solid back home, then you'll be more willing to give. And it's not a very good negotiation tactics.
Very interesting. When we went to break, I was asking you, how do you identify reliable suppliers?
The fact that Chinese are very much a relationship-based culture, you're going to have to use references a lot. Now, identifying very good supplier require very good due diligence. I mean, checking it out. I think Walmart has done a very good job. It's going to require you doing a lot of monitoring, a lot of hand-holding, training. Most of the Chinese have a tendency to subcontract their work out, and that's when you lose control. And that's what you want to make sure that it's not being done for the products that you're going to get from them.
So you really need someone to visit again and again and again and look at production.
I think I would give you an example of some a businessman that I know very well, and he make it a point that he visit the vendors and he keep very good relationship with that particular vendor, and he has never have any problem for the 20 years he buy from this vendor with no contract, nothing whatsoever. His main thing is he goes there 3 times a year. He invite the owner of this company to visit him once or twice a year. They are good friends, and because of that, he never have to worry about he getting any sub-quality products, because if there are any, it's not coming to him.
So, now we've heard stories about adulterated products coming out of China, both into our markets, but also into their own. Would this kind of relationship let you avoid that kind of problem?
In my own estimation, based on my own experience, yes. Now, at the same time, I'm not saying that these things do not happen. When they happen, they are going to send it to people who do not have the right relationship with them or do not have the close scrutiny or monitoring system on their production.
So this is sort of a play on that old Nixon adage, which is to say, trust but verify,
and
relationship but
unfortunately,
verify.
That happened, but I think it happened not just in China, but in China, there may be some cases that have been brought to light, and, you know, it's unfortunately, there's always a few bad apples around, but in general, I have found that the Chinese manufacturer do want to make a good product, and if you go for somebody who has a reputation, who has a good, and they're not going to lose face, they do not want to be associated with that. So people who have a very good reputation, the likelihood of their company doing the right things, building the right product, is much higher than those that do not have a good reputation.
Let's switch gears. For the companies that want to sell into the Chinese market, particularly reach those 200 million to 300 million consumers who are fairly affluent, how do you start to develop a culturally aware marketing communications plan?
Well, I think, you know, go back to the four P's. I think the first thing that you have to determine, not just the product, okay, the first, if the product has any application for the Chinese. Take the fashion, you know, Chinese have a different, you know, complexion. Chinese have a different, you know, line. I mean, a suit or a dress that looks good on an American may not look good on a Chinese woman, vice versa. Cosmetics that may work for American may not work for Asian. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of place, you almost have to clearly identify the location that you want to focus on. My advice to company is you want to pick some places where you have the best connection, meaning that you have people on the ground that can help you. Help you in the sense of, you know, going through, you know, finding you the right distributor, the right retail, the right, all the right people. And that to me is kind of important. And the third thing would be on the promotion, and we can talk a little bit more about that. How do you promote products with the understanding of the cultural values of the Chinese?
And let's go right into that. How do you start to promote your product with an understanding of the cultural values?
Okay. Chinese are very new in the marketing area. I think they're not from Missouri, but I think to show the show me state thing would work for them. Let them see it, let them taste it, let them try it, and that will convince them. And I truly believe that it's similar to the Japanese. There's a lot of on-site promotion. If you can show it, demonstrate it, and then the word of mouth will carry you. And to understand their taste, in terms of color, in terms of, you know, the taste bud, the smell, all these senses, they're all uniquely different. So you're going to have to do some basic research to determine if it is going to work for them.
Are focus groups common in China in terms of determining consumer tastes?
They are starting to, and I have found that to be extremely effective. Even, you know, talking about the wines, I mean, they have a different taste for wine. A lot of them are not educated in it. And they have different tastes. They tend to have a sweeter taste because of the food that they eat, you know, and that depends on which region of China you're from. And, you know, in the Western province where the really the Sichuan, the spicy food is, you have a tendency, you know, you want something that is light and fruity to complement. So somewhere along that line, that is something that is cultural values that have a bearing on what they eat, what they drink, what they dress, and what they're looking for in terms of consumers' products.
Now, Avon years ago went in developing a Chinese sales force, women, and door-to-door. Is that the kind of thing that works?
Well, it actually should work, but I think the government really have some problem with it because you are having groups getting together. And I think that, to me, that is the kind of thing that will, at the community level, will actually help to sell. But unfortunately, getting around the government regulations to do that is going to be a challenge at this time.
So let me ask you another question. If I want to take my products into China, am I better to go in with my global brand, or do I need to develop a local brand?
If your global brand is extremely, well-known, the Coca-Cola of the world, the Pepsi-Cola, Apple, Microsoft, FedEx, okay, since I retired from FedEx, and the competitor UPS, those global brands, they're highly recognized. You really don't have to go for a local brand. Now, if you want to create a local brand for a particular target market, it can be helpful. A sub-brand, could be helpful. And that depends on the local value system. What are you targeting after?
What would be some of the do's and don'ts for developing a local brand? Or at least a brand that's acceptable to locals.
Acceptable to local. I think the thing that would appeal to most of the local people are someone that they can recognize. It's not a hero worship, but Chinese always look up to people, say, that have achieved, say, Jeremy Lin. I mean, Volvo using him to sell cars, Volvo cars in China, I think is going to be a hit, because, they love to cherish not the underdog, but someone of Chinese origin that has quote unquote achieved a certain status. And they look up to those achievements. And that is a very, and what you do with it, just really emphasizing on the ethnicity and the relationship to the Chinese side, that will appeal to them.
Thinking about cultural needs, what are some of the attributes I would need to put into a product to make it desirable? To make
desirable.
It something that, Chinese consumer really wants, looks at, says, mine.
Well, desirable in the sense is if something that is being looked up to, like French wine, the real expensive ones, something that they recognize as highly, the fragrance. I mean, they probably will go for, European fragrances. And, even for apparel, they believe the fashion, very much, more European based. And, to take that into consideration, to have those kind of elements being considered or be part of, the product. Then you have to look at the functionality. Because of the unique nature in China, and there's different part of China will require evaluations.
Okay, that's really, really interesting. Well, got to go to break now. And when we come back, I want to ask you about what some of the due diligence work that companies have to do when they're going to start business in China. So
okay.
Everybody stay tuned, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
The Appalachian Knowledge Economy is a program that explores community development and civic engagement throughout the Appalachian community. Such advancements as rural broadband deployment, sustainable development, and economic forward thinking has moved this region to the forefront of our country's technology and knowledge base. Listen for the Appalachian Knowledge Economy with host Joan Miner every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. I'm here with Marco Chan. He's the CEO of AmAsia 3. And we're talking about how to do business in a culturally aware way, bridge the cultural gaps between Americans, Europeans, and Chinese business. Marco, what are some of the due diligence work that a company has to do when it's going to do business in China?
They really have to do a lot in the local market, and it means finding companies that will help them to, because there's no such thing as a Better Business Bureau and all this, so you're going to have to need references on references and references. The U.S. Department of Commerce can help, you know, give you some preliminary information. The local Chamber of Commerce can help, but there are several local marketing companies that do primary research on companies that exist in the major cities. They can help.
Okay. China has a legal system that's got both traditional Chinese elements and Western elements that came into being at, starting with the market reforms spearheaded by Deng Xiaoping. So there are kind of two systems in China. Can companies get caught in between them?
The Chinese legal system is relatively new, and Chinese, for the last 5,000 years, really a moralistic country. So they value the following the moralistic principles. They're not so much worried about the legal aspects, especially in doing business. They currently, you know, the legal system is being developed and is still very, in my mind, very immature. They're still in the infancy stage. So comparing to the Western legal system that is quite established, there are a big gap. And yes, you're going to find yourself caught in between, and a lot of times when you unfortunately get into some legalistic situation.
One of the legal problems that worries companies the most, and I know it's sort of a Gordian knot, is this question of protecting intellectual property and brand names. Are there some basic things that companies can do? And I know that you said that only companies really that are ultra-aggressive have success here, but are there some basic things, precautions that a company should take?
Yes. I think Chinese do respect all this registration on, you know, in terms of patents and in terms of brand names. I mean, it costs you a little bit of money to get this registered both in the United States and in China. Now, I just wanted to say this is the basic. To challenge that and in the court system in China may take some time. So you will have to make a determination. Is it worth your while to pursue legal recourses if somebody violates your patents or your brand names? As you pointed out, there's a gap, and there is really a gap. The aggressive company like Disney, I mean, they do a lot of that, and while you still see some counterfeits, they're a lot less. This is one of those issues that is now being highlighted by Chinese government, especially with Chinese companies having patents in a lot of their new products. I think after a while, and hopefully in the next 5-10 years, things will level out and everybody will respect each other's patents.
Interesting. So now that there's something to protect, they're going to be more likely to offer protection to others.
Yes.
So one of the other areas that's concerning to companies doing business in China can be government censorship. Now, we've read about it in terms of Google and some of the internet, but one of our listeners sent me an email this morning. She tried to email her son, who's working in Shanghai, the description of the show, the evite that we send out. She thought the show would be useful for him, and the email was blocked by the government. So are businesses going to face that, where the government often blocks emails?
I heard about it, but I really do not have any knowledge. Number one, I do not know if it was really being blocked by the government or there's some other technical issues involved. Number two, censorship, I think it exists. And to what level it exists, I do not know. For the person who has emailed you, sometimes some of the email address, service provider there may not be as good, and sometimes the email do get lost in between. So you may want to take a look of that before we make the assumption saying that it's the government censorship that blocked the email from being received. And I'm not saying that it's not happening or it's happening. I really do not know.
Very briefly, we talked a little bit before the show about one of the complexities facing foreign business in China is the need to navigate layers of government, and you've got a lot of different actors. You've got the Communist Party, you've got the government bureaucracy, you've got the Red Army. They're all actors in China's economy, and we don't have enough time to go into all that with this show. But what is an essential thing that companies should keep in mind when negotiating with government officials?
Well, I mean, when you're negotiating with government official, I would assume that you're negotiating for licenses, or are you talking about government officials who serve as the chief executive for the state-owned enterprise?
Well, let's start with for licenses.
Well, I think with different ministries, I think the transparency is there. I mean, the time it will take to navigate through that, again, it really depends on how you approach it. I think if you happen to know you have some reference, some referral, you may be able to, you know, have a much smoother timeline. And I think most of the government officials that I have worked with in the past are very, very open in discussion.
And what about government officials who are executives at a state-owned enterprise?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things, and this has been, you know, published many times in Wall Street and other business journals, that, you know, the chief executives in major state-owned enterprises, in all state-owned enterprises, are actually appointed by the party, and the party has control over it. And so a lot of times they get switched around, and And so, you know, so there are those who are, you know, they will provide different direction to the growth of companies. And you would have to keep that in mind. I mean, if that person has been there for quite a few years, it may be time for them to be rotated out to some of the state-owned enterprises or go back to the ministry. And you see a lot of those. I mean, people who are minister, deputy minister, becoming chief executives, and chief executives becoming ministers. So,
a revolving door. The U.S. has one, too. Let me ask you, because we're running out of time now, your company is AmAsia 3. What does the 3 stand for?
Well, the 3 stands for commerce, community, and culture. What we truly believe is to be successful in the Trans-Pacific business, doing business with Asian, particularly China, you really need to be part of the community. And so the community, the Chinese community in America and the Chinese community in different cities, in different provinces in China, will help to get things done more smoothly. And secondly, you have to respect the culture, you know, of the Chinese, and the Chinese have to respect the culture of the American, vice versa. And with that understanding, it will avoid a lot of misunderstanding, and it would actually help each other out to improve commerce both ways.
That's really
interesting.
That's the 3. Now, tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, please.
I'm sorry?
Can you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you if they want to follow up?
Oh, well, they can call me, or they can actually email me at mchan@amasia3.net. That's my email address. Or go to the website. You know, it's amasia3.com.
Great. Now, we've got about 1 minute left. And what's the one most important thing our listeners should take away from this show?
Be respectful of the Chinese culture. Understand that. Understand, learn as much about Chinese culture as much as you can. And learn to build relationship first.
That's terrific. Listen, this has been a fascinating show, and I really appreciate it. And if you've got any follow-up questions, you can also send me an email at trr@globalreach-sbi.com. We'd love to get your questions. I'd love suggestions for future shows. Thank you all so much for listening. And Marco, thank you so much for giving us your time today.
My pleasure.
And your expertise.
Thank you.
Have a great week, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.